Before I begin, I just want to ask you about something. I got an email from the UCLA store saying that the Utley book, Going to War with Japan, was out of print. And I just wanted to see if any of you had any trouble getting that book. You had trouble getting it? My advice to you is to just order it from Amazon.com. It was, I checked yesterday, and it's still in print there. They didn't say it was out of print, and you could get it from them. It's we have plenty of time for that. So I'm actually a little puzzled. I mean, why would they say it's out of print when, in fact, you could easily get it? But all right, today I'm going to be talking about the First World War, the war itself, not the origins of the war. And this is, in a sense, this is kind of unusual because people who study international politics are interested mainly in what causes a war. There's a huge literature, huge libraries written on the question of what caused the First World War. It's still after, you know, it's practically a century now. In a couple of years, we'll be celebrating, in quotes, the outbreak of the First World War. And it still is a very contentious subject among both historians and political scientists. How is it to be understood? That sort of thing is the focus of intellectual inquiry, not what happened after the war broke out. You know, the assumption is, well, once the war breaks out, diplomats have failed, the generals take over, the two sides will just fight it out until one side or the other, throws in the towel. I mean, that's sort of assumption. But when you think about it, that kind of assumption doesn't make very much sense in general, because politics continues even after the outbreak of a war, you know. There is always the question of what the terms will be for ending the war, what the war aims will be, will the neutrals come in, and so on. So politics continues after the outbreak of the war. In this particular case, the issue is particularly salient. Why? Because there was no rapid decision. It was, you know, the Germans had hoped. They were betting on the prospect that if they implemented the Schlieffen Plan, if they took advantage of the fact that they could mobilize much more quickly than the Russians, and therefore at the beginning of the war, the first couple of weeks of the war, they wouldn't have to worry seriously about defending their eastern borders. And so they wouldn't have to put too much of their army in the east. Let me just get the map up here. And can concentrate all their forces in the west and not throw them against the French fortresses on the Franco-German border, but march through Belgium and encircle the French armies in northern France. Deal France a knockout blow before Britain could mobilize in a serious way. Before Britain could bring the principal instrument of her power to bear, namely naval power, which is effective through blockade and the economic starvation of the target, that sort of thing matters in a long war, but not in a short war. If you could knock France out at the beginning of the war, then you could turn around and deal with Russia, and you would kind of be able to prevail in the war. But it was a gamble. This was the Schlieffen Plan. They understood it was a gamble. 1914, still a good chance that it could succeed. Not by 1917, hopeless. That was one of the big factors that was pushing the Germans forward in 1914. We might be able to win now. If we waited another few years, our situation would be hopeless. If Russia was going to pursue this sort of aggressive policy in the Balkans now, then when they're relatively weak, there will be no living with them in the future when they're relatively strong. Therefore, war is inevitable. If war is inevitable, better sooner than later. better have it before our window of opportunity closes. Right? So that's the German plan. They implemented it at the beginning of the war. They marched through Belgium. Right? They attack the French armies in France. They leave their eastern border relatively undefended. But they can't quite pull it off. Right? The French are able to hold the Germans at bay. And the war in the West essentially stabilizes. You know, a huge line of trenches, network of trenches stretching all across northern France from the Swiss border straight through to the English Channel. And French warfare demonstrated the superiority of the defense in land warfare. Right? You just dig these trenches and you man the trenches with well-armed troops, troops armed with machine guns. The other side tries to launch an offensive. You just mow them down with machine gun fire. And that was true for both sides. Both sides were immobilized very rapidly at the beginning of the war. It was a military stalemate on the most important front, the Western Front, from late 1914 to early 1918, right? Because the defense was dominant. Because this whole business of earthworks, trenches and machine guns and so on, could immobilize the enemy's offensive forces. Very hard to concentrate your forces. You need to concentrate your forces to have any chance for successful offensive action. But if forces are concentrated, your adversary could just target you with artillery fire. That would be very effective in destroying your ability to launch offensives. For all these reasons, the war bogs down into a war of attrition. A war in which the offense has the upper hand. Now, why is this? Why is there a puzzle here? All this stuff is very familiar. All these movies about the First World War and so on, you all know. Why is it a puzzle? Well, it doesn't make any sense. The fact that you have a military stalemate shows that the two sides are of approximately equal power. If they're of approximately equal power, then you think that the two sides would agree on some sort of compromise. Status quo ante or something like that. A negotiated peace. A compromise peace. A peace that did not amount to the total destruction of one side, the total defeat of one side, and the total victory of the other side. Right? There's a whole body of international relations thought which suggests that this is the rational outcome of this sort of situation. The taproot of this whole body of thought is a book by a historian, an Australian historian named Geoffrey Blainey, and it's called The Causes of War. And Blainey's argument is, you only have war because the different sides assess the power relationship differently. Right? They can't both be right. If both sides understood what the power relationship actually was, they would adjust their policies accordingly. They would reach compromise settlements and so on. Right? The political outcomes would be a function of the mutually agreed upon assessment of what the real balance of power actually was. So if you're going to have a war, this is Blaney's argument, it has to be because there's a difference. Each side overrates its chances of success, right? It's this undue optimism on at least one side, and probably on both sides, that accounts for the outbreak of a war. Right? It's like, we could take a hard line because we think we're going to win. If the other side agreed with that assessment, it would pull back. But the other side also thinks, well, we could win too, so we could dig in our heels too. All right, so you have that conflict, based on false optimism on both sides, is the central taproot of war. Right? So otherwise you'd have a political accommodation. And then the international relations theorists took this idea and they ran with it and made it absolutely central to their explanation of why have war. The most important article here is an article called Rationalist Explanations for War that was published in the mid-1990s by James Fearon. It's probably the single most important article in international relations theory to be published in the last 20 or 30 years. And this is the Fearon argument. If if war has a rational basis, it has to be rooted in the fact that the two sides don't share a common assessment of what the power realities are. They have to disagree. And the only way they can disagree, and here he's drawing on an important body of thought developed in economics, the only way they can disagree is if they have different sources of information. Because if everyone knew everything, if information were totally open, information about both capabilities and resolve, and interest and material power. If everything were understood by everybody, everyone rationally would be able to reason toward the same conclusions about what the outcome of a war would be. And if everyone agrees about what the outcome of a war would be, you're not going to have a war. You're going to have a political settlement that reflects that common understanding. Right? So this is the... And this argument then goes on to say, so if you do have a war, it could only be because the two sides don't share that common informational base. That one side or the other has what's called private information, information that the other side doesn't have that allows it to take a tougher line. And why do countries have private information? Why do they not disclose, what the real situation is? Well, they have bargaining advantages for not disclosing things, for feigning greater confidence than they actually feel, and so on and so on and so on. So that's the international relations theory context for approaching this particular puzzle. Why don't you have a compromise settlement? And the reason why it's a puzzle is, well, that might explain the outbreak of the war in 1914, that both sides were unduly optimistic when the war broke out. But the effect of the war itself, the fact that a military stalemate had taken shape along the front in northern France, that should have provided the information that was missing in July 1914. No more private information. Now everything's out in the public. Everyone can see that the two sides are of approximately equal power because that's why you have this more or less permanent stalemate there. And so now that everyone sees what the realities are, that the scales have been torn from people's eyes and people could have the information about the military balance that they need, well, they should have been able to, if they were rational, reach some sort of compromise settlement. But they don't. They fight the war until the bitter end. It doesn't make sense. This is the perspective of international relations theory. And you could draw on other traditions of international relations theory which point in the same direction. Say, is it rational for say, a country like Britain, even a country like France, to want to fight the war to the bitter end? Fight the war to the bitter end, what does that mean? Destruction of German power. Total victory over Germany. Reducing Germany to a political cipher. Well, what's the effect of that? If you destroy German power, there's a power vacuum in Central Europe. What's going to keep Russian power at bay? What's going to keep Russia from dominating all of Europe? Don't you want, if you're a status quo power like Britain, because Britain, don't forget, has this huge empire in the world is not interested in gaining any more territory or anything like that. Is interested mainly in peace, mainly in its security. If you're a country like Britain, wouldn't you want a relatively strong Germany to serve as a counterweight to Russia? And by the same token, a relatively strong Russia to serve as a counterweight to Germany. So that you're dependent on neither Russia nor on Germany, but can profit from the fact that those two powers, by virtue of the fact that they have a common military border there in the east, are more concerned with the threat from each other than either is from the threat from you. So you could play on those differences. You could balance between Germany and Russia and so secure your position in the world and also secure a relatively peaceful international order. Right? That's the perspective of traditional balance of power theory as it was developed in the 18th century by the great balance of power theorists. Probably you've never heard of these people. People like Fénelon. Fénelon says at the beginning of the 18th century, the whole trick of conducting policy is to avoid raising your allies up too high or pushing your enemies down too low. You want that balance. You want that equilibrium of power because the stability of the system, your own liberty plus a relatively peaceful order is very much a function of your ability to secure that kind of balance. Right. So that's the that's another tradition which points to the conclusion that rationally, if these countries had been rational, they would have negotiated a compromise peace. Doesn't make sense. And so, looking back in the First World War, there's this whole body of thought that developed. The Kennan article that you read for this week is an example of that. There are very important lessons to be drawn from this. The main lesson was, it was absurd to treat victory as an end in itself. Warfare should be understood in political terms. You shouldn't think solely of defeating the enemy. That's a huge error. What you should think of, you should be thinking in terms of, how can we create a stable international order? How can we end the war in such a way that the damage to the international order is limited, and that after the war we have a stable system. We're fighting the war not because victory is an end in itself, we're fighting it for political purposes. Right? Now, that's the argument that you should make about what happened in 1914. They went wrong. This was not the way to conduct policy. This sort of argument drew on the thought of the great Prussian military theorist Karl von Clausewitz. Right? The Clausewitz argument was, war has to be understood, or as an extension of politics. As policy pursued by other means. War and politics were of a piece. You can't separate these things and say, once a war breaks out, only military considerations should come into play. The only thing you should be concerned with is defeating the enemy. Political considerations about the kind of world that's going to emerge from this, you should push out of your mind. Clausewitz says, big mistake to take that sort of approach. One of these days, if you ever get a chance, you should read some of the selections from Clausewitz's great work. It's called On War. And he says, for example, war has its own grammar, but not its own logic. That logic can only be supplied from the outside by political direction. Right? The pursuit of armed conflict should be subject to political direction, to political control. Because the whole point of using violence is to achieve political goals. And the problem, people argued, about the First World War was that victory became a kind of end in itself. The aim was to win. Right? People were not thinking in political terms. If you want to see a beautiful example of this this line of argument. The book you should look at is Bernard Brody's book. It came out in 1959, called The Strategy in the Missile Age. Bernard Brody was one of the great strategic thinkers of the nuclear age. You know, he and Thomas Schelling were, really at the very top. And Brody, I should say, was a member of our own political science department here at UCLA for many years, probably the most distinguished member of that department ever. And in setting up his analysis of nuclear strategy, and in effect, flagging those things that were wrong with American nuclear strategy, namely that it was based too narrowly on purely military considerations. To set that up, Brody had a whole chapter in which he talked about the First World War and how the aim was to win and how political considerations were suppressed and how, and he quotes Churchill to the effect that, just the fires raged until they burned themselves out. Brody says, that's not the way to conduct things. And in more contemporary international relations thought, you think of international politics in general, both in time of peace and in time of war, in bargaining terms. Right? The everything is a bargain. Whether to continue with the violence or to stop it, that has to be understood in bargaining terms. Can you reach an understanding with the other side? Right? So Thomas Schelling, for example, insists that any form of war termination has to be understood as the result of a bargain. And he makes the point very effectively because he says, well, even unconditional surrender has to be understood as in bargaining terms. He says, compare unconditional surrender with unconditional extermination. You know, there's an implicit bargain, implicit understanding that if we surrender, you're not going to simply come in and wipe us out. Okay? So the whole story of the First World War presents us with this puzzle, which is very interesting in that theoretical context. If these are the expectations, if this is the sort of thing that you would expect, compromise peace, negotiated peace, why don't you have it? Right? It's like, why is it that people diverge somewhat from these, from the kind of rationalist tradition, from the balance of power tradition, so on? And it is profoundly puzzling, and it's puzzling because of its enormous importance. The First World War is important not because it broke out. If it had been settled within a few weeks after it had become clear that there was a military stalemate, it would not have had anything like the importance it had historically in the 20th century. It was of such extraordinary importance because of the huge casualties which resulted from the fact that there was no compromise peace. I mean, you realize how enormous those casualties were. Here's France, for example, a country of only 40 million people. 1,300,000 Frenchmen were killed in the war. Hundreds of thousands of others, maimed and injured in very serious ways. The entire male half of a generation, in fact, was essentially wiped out in France. You go to France today, you go to these little villages, and can't be more than a few hundred people living in the village, and the town square, they always have like a monument to the dead of the World Wars, and you see like small villages, like 40, 50 names for the First World War, three or four for the Second World War. This was an enormously devastating conflict with extraordinary repercussions throughout the century. Second World War, Bolshevik Revolution, and so on. They're inconceivable without the fact that the First World War took on the form it did. It wasn't inevitable. And, you know, if a different set of theoretical notions had kind of guided policy, well, then you could have avoided all of this. You could have. And so that's the argument people like Kennan make, people like Brody make, and so on. Okay, so we have the puzzle. How's it to be understood? Well, you could come up with certain explanations, not to be understood in terms of pure realist theory, but which pivot on the importance of domestic politics, domestic political considerations, in the wartime context. Because the fact that there was a stalemate, that simply implied to a lot of people that you had to break the stalemate. And to break the stalemate, you had to mobilize every single last ounce of the energies of your own people. Because on the margin, when things are evenly balanced, you know, all these additional things can make a difference. And how do you mobilize the energies of your own people? You tell them how awful things would be if you didn't win. If you have to blacken your enemy and make it seem like your enemy is the embodiment of evil. Because otherwise, how do you justify the enormous sacrifices you're asking them to make? Once you start talking about compromise peace, negotiated peace, well, then there's this whole danger that your morale is going to collapse at home. How can you ask people to make sacrifices if the war isn't being fought for some overarching goal, if it's going to be ended with some sort of political accommodation? Right? You have to hold up for your own people the prospect of a dramatically different world after the war is over, which is kind of inconsistent with compromise. You have to tell them this war is so awful that we're going to make sure after it's over that there's going to be no repetition. We need guarantees to prevent that. Now, guarantees, as it turned out, was just a code term that came into being among all the belligerents, at least the European belligerents, for harsh peace terms. For peace terms that would keep your adversary down, territorial changes, and so on. And it's not. There's a famous book about Germany's war aims by Fritz Fischer. It's translated into English as Germany's Aims in the First World War, and Fischer showed how the Germans had all these annexationist war aims. Absolutely true, and but he jumped to the conclusion that that was why the Germans had fought the war in the first place, not necessarily a valid conclusion. The important point to notice, however, is that Germany wasn't the only country that had these sorts of war aims, and France especially. You had the term guarantees being used by the political leadership openly as a code word for annexations. You know? And the French approached their main continental ally, Russia, and to talk about these things in the middle of the war. And each of them supports the other's annexationist goals. Russia wants to expand down to the Turkish Straits, get control of the Turkish Straits. The Russians, for their part, support the French ambition of pushing their military frontier into the Rhine. The Tsar says, naming a few cities in the Rhineland, German cities. He says, take Mainz, take Koblenz, go further still if you judge it useful. Right? Again, in a war of this sort, you're worried about whether your own alliance is going to remain intact. You know, whether your ally is going to be tempted to work out some sort of compromise peace with your enemy. And so to prevent that from happening, you have to keep upping the ante to make sure that your ally is getting what your ally wants so that your ally will stay the course. Another dynamic that enters into the equation here. And so, in the military stalemate, instead of leading to a moderation of war aims, as the rationalist theory would suggest, has the effect of leading to an escalation of war aims. We have to hold, put forward as our goal the total transformation of the system, the total destruction of the evil power that we're fighting against, and so on. For all of these mainly domestic political reasons. Right? And you see this phenomenon across the board in all of the belligerents, regardless of their internal political system. And in particular, you see it in the case of the United States. Woodrow Wilson, President of the United States in this period, lays out a policy, a set of aims, in a famous speech, the Peace Without Victory speech, late January 1917, barely 2 months before the United States actually entered into the war. Victory would mean peace forced upon the loser, a victor's terms imposed upon the vanquished. It would be accepted in humiliation, under duress, and an intolerable sacrifice, and would leave a sting, a resentment, a bitter memory upon which terms of peace would rest, not permanently, but only as upon quicksand. Only a peace between equals can last. Only the peace, a peace, the very principle of which is equality and a common participation and a common benefit. Right? Peace without victory. But soon as the Americans go into the war, 2 months later, all of this stuff is thrown above, it's thrown out the window. And this week you had to read a number of these Wilson wartime speeches. And it's quite extraordinary, the line he was taking. The very beginning of that speech at the end of 1917, recommending a declaration of war with Austria-Hungary. He says, "I shall not go back to debate the causes of the war. The intolerable wrongs done and planned against us by the sinister masters of Germany have long since become too grossly obvious and odious to every true American to need to be rehearsed." It's a big attack on the whole notion of a compromise peace, on the importance of overcoming evil. And he refers to this intolerable thing of which the masters of Germany have shown us the ugly face, this menace of combined intrigue and force which we now see so clearly as the German power, a thing without conscience or honor or capacity for covenanted peace, must be crushed, and if it be not utterly brought to an end, at least shut out from the friendly intercourse of the nations. It's just like, crush them, destroy them. They're evil. No compromise with evil. It's hard to avoid the conclusion that the shift had something to do with the fact that the first speech was given before the United States came into the war, and the second speech after. Because once you come into the war, your whole psychology just changes. Right. Why? Because if we were forced to go to war, that can only be because the other side is just so bad. When you're not in the war, you can be relatively dispassionate. You're objective. You're outside of all this stuff. You could talk about compromise peace. Once you're in because the other side is evil. And if the other side is evil, you've got to crush the other side. Right? There's this big myth that Wilson was a big believer in a moderate peace, a peace of reconciliation, so on, that the whole line that he laid out in the Peace Without Victory speech remained at the heart of U.S. policy throughout the Wilsonian period. Not true at all. We're going to be talking about this in greater detail. And it's important to see that it's not true because our goal, of course, one of our goals, is to try and understand whether there are basic principles which should serve as guidelines for the proper conduct of foreign policy. You know, the argument that Kennan lays out in that that piece that you read for this week about what policy should be, is that Kennan argument basically correct? Right, that's going to be a big issue for us. All right. So you're not going to have a compromise peace for a variety of reasons. It's now looking back in the first part of the war before the Americans came in. And what that means is that the peace is going to have to be ended one or two ways: by adopting new military tactics and new military strategies that will result in the defeat of the enemy, right? In a military decision, military victory, or by bringing in hitherto neutral powers, getting them to intervene on the war on your side, and in that way shift the balance in what had become a war of attrition. Okay? And so those two courses of action become the focus of policy during the war period itself. And lots of new things are tried during the war. Poison gas, for example, was used in the First World War in the hope that this would enable one side or the other to reach a military decision. The submarine blockade of Britain adopted, you know, the use of the submarine, a new weapon essentially in war, to reach a military decision. There's the great problem of how can you overcome the advantages of the defense in land warfare, this whole system with the trenches and barbed wire and the machine guns and so on. There's an answer to that. A technical answer. That answer is the tank, which was developed during the First World War. The tank, this is a bit of a digression, but the tank is kind of an obvious solution to this problem. Because you had the Caterpillar tractor, which had been developed for agricultural purposes before the First World War. It's just the internal combustion engine, which, you know, was the basis of the automobile, applied to agriculture. You put it on these treads so it could, you know, move over any terrain. And so it was just the question of taking the Caterpillar tractor, providing it with defensive armor, giving it some offensive guns, including machine guns for immediate defense, and that would enable you to restore the possibility of offensive military action, so that your offenses wouldn't be frustrated by simply being mowed down by the enemy's machine gun fire. So, and in fact, toward the end of the war, you, thanks to the tank, you did, and to all the attrition that had been introduced, you had the restoration of a war of movement, right? All sorts of other, but the professional military are very reluctant to go this route. The professional military had to have the tank forced down their throats by the civilians. This, you know, another one of these kind of odd pathologies. Tactics in the sense of how the military forces you have would be used. The Germans in 1918, hoping for a rapid military decision before American power could really be brought to bear, adopt new tactics, this shock troop tactics, to kind of restore the possibility of offensive action. You know, local successes, but basically strategic failure. Right? So there's a big effort on the military side to reach a decision. And for most of this period, it doesn't quite work. There are answers to all of these things. The submarine war, initially quite effective, but then they come up with the convoy system, where the merchant ships would be assembled in convoys and protected by destroyers who were prepared to conduct anti-submarine warfare. Right? So there's no decision, really, before 1918 that results from military innovation. On the other hand, the entry of other powers into the war does play an important role. And the diplomacy of the war focuses in very large measure on the intervention of the neutrals. And so, in fact, you do have Italy and Romania intervening in the war on the side of the Entente. Basically, the Italians are bought off by the Entente with promises of territorial gains against Austria. Bulgaria and Turkey intervene in the war on the side of the Central Powers. These are minor countries, even Italy, a fairly minor country in terms of the effect that its intervention had on the overall military situation. But the one great neutral that's can't be put in that category at all. And that, of course, is the United States. United States, 1913. As strong as all five belligerents, European great power belligerents, put together in terms of its military potential. Because the key index of military potential in those days is the size of your industrial economy as measured, given the military technology of this period, by steel production. You look at the figures for steel production. The United States is producing just about as much steel as all five of the European belligerents combined. We don't have, because America is so secure, right? Weak enemies to the north and south, huge oceans to the east and west. No one wants to pick a fight with us. You know, intrinsically the strongest country in the world. You don't have to build up an interventionist military capability. You're secure. You don't have to worry about these things. So America doesn't have very much of a force in being. It has this enormous military potential, but that potential is going to take a long time to have an impact on the course of the fighting in Europe once America intervenes. And so, and the Germans understand this. That's why the Germans understand that they have a certain window within which they could hope to knock the British and the French out of the war before the Americans intervene. Right? And they're desperate because in a war of attrition, the Germans, in the long run, they're doomed to defeat. So the Germans opt for the submarine war in the beginning of 1917, out of this sort of desperation. And it's the submarine war that's the issue that, at least ostensibly, brings the Americans into the war in April. And so we have this whole problem of, well, that's the public explanation, that's the official cause, but is that really how American intervention is to be understood? Yeah. American intervention was a decisive event, decisive in the history of our country and the history of the world, as well as in the history of the war. American intervention in the First World War meant, as soon as it became clear that the German gamble had not paid off, and that although Britain and France were shaken, they were not defeated by the submarine offensive and the other German offensives. America would mobilize, would train a large army, would be able to transport that army and deploy it in the fighting in Europe. And once that happened, these fresh American troops, they would turn the tide of battle sooner or later. How is the American intervention to be understood? Is it to be understood in power political terms? Well, that's an argument that some scholars make. They say you can't pay that much attention to the rhetoric. These people in charge of American policy, they knew what the real situation was in Europe. They knew how the Entente powers were really shaken, how they could scarcely go... continue with their military effort. Look at the revolution in Russia, the so-called February Revolution in Russia, which took place in March, actually, because the Russians are on a different calendar. Right before the Americans intervened, the submarine war, which is causing all this havoc and fears of famine within Britain, very effective at the outset. The French army, you know, rocked by these mutinies in the early spring. You know, scholars like John Mearsheimer, very important book, The Tragedy of Great Power Politics. He makes this argument about American policy. They intervened, he says, for power political reasons. They knew how important it was for them that there be a counterweight to German power in Europe, that it was intolerable from the U.S. point of view if Britain and France fell and Germany were to emerge as a European hegemon. That's why, he says, the Americans intervened. The only problem is that's not what the U.S. leadership was thinking at the time. When they made the decisions to intervene, they didn't think the Entente was on its last legs. We may think that in retrospect, but that was not their view at the time. They were actually encouraged by the events in Russia. Russia's becoming a democracy. This is great. A democratic power will be able to mobilize the energies of its own people, and so on. The French mutinies were still in the future when the decision to intervene was made. Americans had no idea of how devastating the submarine war was to Britain because the Britons didn't want to give the Americans that information. So then you have, you know, the other argument that, and this is the argument of the Kennan piece. The Kennan argument is, the whole problem with American policy was that it was not thinking in those terms, not thinking in terms of the balance of power and of moderating your war aims and intervening for strategic reasons, for geopolitical reasons, for reasons having to do with the maintenance of an equilibrium of power in Europe. They should have been thinking in those terms, but they weren't. And the fact that they weren't explains why Wilson screwed everything up. Say you look at this American policy during that period, and it's totally nutty. This is what Kennan is saying. You know, it's like, before we intervene in the war, oh, we can't be bothered with Europe. You know, it's relatively unimportant. You know, it's like, well, this is their problem. See, what do you expect? These Europeans with all their power politics, you know, they get into this thing. This is not America's concern. And then, as soon as we intervene over the issue of the submarines, oh, this is a matter of the whole future of humanity. It's a struggle of good versus evil. And Kennan's saying, isn't America like one of these kind of prehistoric dinosaurs that's just content to be, wallowing in the mud, and you practically have to, you know, hit him on the head with a brick in order to get his attention, but as soon as his attention is aroused, he slashes around furiously and destroys everything in his local neighborhood. That's not the way to conduct a policy. You have to be more grown up. This whole Wilsonian notion of basing your policy on moral principles, this is childish. You know, you have to pursue a policy based on geopolitical imperatives. Keep your moralistic concerns down because they mess everything up. Now that's the realist critique of U.S. foreign policy in general, and it's supported by a particular analysis, a particular interpretation of U.S. Policy during the Wilsonian period, the interpretation that Kennan lays out there. So what are we to make of U.S. policy? Appear. Why did they intervene? The submarine war? Well, in a sense, yes, because if it hadn't been for the submarine war, it's very hard to imagine them intervening. Even if the Germans were about to win the war in Europe without resorting to the submarine blockade. Right? Hard to imagine. So they weren't really thinking in geopolitical terms. On the other hand, the policy was not rooted in a simple-minded insistence on the importance of maintaining respect for America's rights as a neutral to trade with whoever she wanted. Because the American government was perfectly willing to tolerate British restrictions on American trade, not just with Germany directly, but with the neutrals that had a common land border with Germany, countries like Holland and Denmark. American trade with those countries was also subject to the British blockade. And this the Americans were willing to tolerate. Well, so it's not a mindless commitment to neutral rights. obviously political considerations came into play, but you do get the sense when you're looking at American policy in that period that there are all kinds of things that came into to the minds of Wilson and his top collaborators, and he's not pulling them together in a unified strategic concept. Right? People like to say that in his heart he remained a true believer in the goal of peace without victory. But if so, it's very hard to see that as reflected in the policy that he actually pursued after America came into the war, and indeed in the policy that he pursued at the end of the war and at the peace conference in 1919. So I'm out of time today, so that's where we're going to pick up next time with the Paris Peace Conference and the whole question of how to judge the Wilson policy.